Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Gretchen McCulloch.
And I'm Claire Gorn, and in this 24th Patreon bonus episode, we talk about when accents meet.
But first, Claire, you're not Lauren.
I'm not indeed.
Lauren has recently had her baby, which is very exciting. So this bonus episode is bringing you behind the scenes a bit more with our audio producer, Claire, who you may know, or not really know that you already know, as the silent eyes and ears that keeps these episodes ticking along merrily on your behalf.
That's me.
Claire is also Lauren's sister.
I am. I'm basically Lauren with straight hair.
Okay, that's fair. And you live in Edinburgh, right?
I do, yeah. I've been living here for almost 3 years now.
So we thought we'd talk about, especially since I recently got back from Australia, what it feels like when accents and dialects come into contact and how we interact with each other about them. So Claire, what have you noticed as an Australian living in Scotland?
I've noticed a lot of things. Firstly, I've noticed that living in Edinburgh means that I'm quite sheltered from the Scottish accent, if I'm being honest. The accent here in Edinburgh, it's not as strong as most people associate with a Scottish accent. A lot of people describe it as being quite soft.
So it's more similar to other British accents or other accents you're familiar with?
Yeah, exactly. And I also work in an industry where I encounter a lot of tourists, so I hear a lot of American accents and I hear like a lot of European accents. But there have been a few things that I've come across. Usually it's me getting teased mercilessly by co-workers and friends for what they perceive as my odd pronunciation, or vice versa. So I was wondering, Gretchen, if I was to ask you to tell me the name of the animal that's kind of like a turtle, but it walks on land, what would you call it?
A tortoise?
Yeah, same. In Australia, we call them a tortoise.
Okay.
Here in Scotland, and I'm told the rest of the UK, they call them a tortoise.
Oh, I have heard this, but I would not say this.
Yeah, so I've been living here for, as I said, like 3 years, and I only encountered this like 2 months ago. It blew my mind.
Tortoise. That sounds like you just read this word in a book and you didn't actually know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And you just assumed based on the spelling. But it's probably the case that this is the pronunciation that this spelling was designed to represent and that, you know, the accents both of us have just actually pronounce it differently.
Yeah. Well, we decided to go to the ultimate source on this to find out what the true pronunciation should be. And we Googled David Attenborough saying the word. And he says tortoise.
Wait, he doesn't say tortoise?
No, which I think might have been at the behest of some producers wanting to broaden his appeal.
Appeal to the American audiences. Probably Americans say tortoise, because I don't imagine I say this differently.
Yeah,
from
I have
Americans.
Never in my whole life heard it pronounced tortoise. And I consume a lot of, like, British media.
Yeah, it's not completely unfamiliar to me, but it's, yeah, not what I would say, for sure. Any other examples?
Yeah, I asked a co-worker to pass me a particular coloured object, and I said, can you please pass me the lilac one? And she looked at me with horror, because it turns out here it's pronounced lilac.
I would say lilac, which is yet different again.
Oh, interesting. Like lilac, like with more of an O sound?
Yeah, like a lock and key lilac.
Oh, wow, okay, that is completely different, yeah.
I could say lilac, maybe, but I think I would say lilac first.
Oh, interesting. Well, because I then was like, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I have been mispronouncing it, so I asked a bunch of friends to send me voice messages pronouncing this word, and all of my Australian yeah. friends pronounce it lilac. And I have had to shift the way I pronounce it because I can't get anything done if I say the word lilac for the next 10 minutes. It's just lilac, haha.
Wait, and how do your coworkers say it?
Lilac.
Lilac.
Yeah.
Oh, the stress on the first syllable. Okay.
Yes.
Lilac. I mean, yeah, I don't know, like, all of these just sound, like, fine to me. I think I could understand them all, but I would say lilac. Yet it different again.
I'd never heard it as lilac. It was, and I think I had, but lilac had never sounded incorrect to me, but yeah. They had never heard it before.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So I copped a little flack for that one. I recently asked someone to pass me a Hessian sack, which I'm not sure what kind of image that brings to your mind, but like a, you know, rough fabric sack that you would sort of see like coffee beans
like
in.
Like a burlap sack?
Yeah. to me, that fabric has always been called Hessian. And again, horrified looks, because apparently here it's pronounced Hessian.
That's one of those words that, like, when I see written down, I don't actually know how to say it, because it's not very common, because I call the sack like a burlap or like a hemp sack or something like that.
Yeah.
And I only have Hessian in boots.
Oh, interesting. I've never heard them in that context.
Hessian boots? I don't actually know what they look like, but I've definitely read them in novels before. But I think it's one of those words that I've only read, and so I don't know if I would say Hessian or Hessian, because I just don't say it that often.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you call burlap, I've always called Hessian. And
okay.
Yeah, it's a double S, but that's how I pronounce it, and yeah.
But SI often creates a sh sound, so, like, it could do that.
Yes, well, according to my Scottish friends, it's Hessian.
Ah,
and I was laughed out of town for that one. One that I found interesting that we kind of merged on was pronunciation of the word car park.
Mm-hmm. So I would say car park, but that's because I have R's.
Yes. I don't have R's, and nor do... it was actually a friend who's from the north of England.
Mm-hmm.
So Scots do have quite a strong R mm-hmm. sound, but people in the north of England don't. It basically sounds like an H, and I was kind of teasing her a little bit for how she wasn't pronouncing her R's. And then she was like, so how do you say it? And I said car park. And she's like, it's exactly the same. It's like, oh, Lord, it is.
Oh, no, you've been caught out. Yeah. There's a funny story about this. The first time, actually, that I was hanging out with Lauren at a conference when we finally met in person, and there was another Australian linguist named Barb Kelly, and she was introducing herself to somebody, and she's like, you know, hi, I'm Bob. And this other person who is American was like, oh, Bob? Like, you know, maybe your name's Roberta and you go by Bob. And she's like, oh, yeah, Bob. And I was like, as in short for Barbara. And then Barb had to be like, yes, Barb. Which is, of course, not how she says her own name.
Oh, names are always an awkward one because you worry so much about giving personal offense.
Like, she knows that it has an R in it. And if your dialect has an R, you should be saying the R.
Yeah.
Even if she doesn't actually say the R in her own name. Because if I call her Bob, that's really weird.
Yeah.
I had this recently when I was in Australia, because everyone was like, yeah, you have to reduce all the names. You have to say Melbourne. You can't say Melbourne. You have to say Canberra. You don't say Canberra and stuff like this. And I was like, great. Okay. Like, I've got the memo. This sounds good. And then I said Queensland because I was like, yeah, I'm reducing things. And people were like, nah.
See, to me, Queensland just sounds like you're saying Queensland with a New Zealand accent.
Yeah, no, I was like, I'm just trying to reduce all these vowels here.
I just want to fit in.
I'm trying so hard.
Yeah, place names are a real struggle. Living here, I get so many Americans saying Edinburgh.
Whoa. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. What?
Because Edinburgh is spelled E-D-I-N-B-U-R-G-H. And they just look at that and they pronounce all the letters.
Sure, but, like, it's a well-known city. That just surprises me.
Yeah. another one is Glasgow being pronounced Glasgow by
yes. Okay,
a lot
Glasgow.
Of tourists as well. You can tell someone hasn't been here long when they're saying that.
Yeah, I've always known how to say Glasgow, but now that I'm thinking about it, I think it's because I grew up in Nova Scotia, which of course has,
yeah.
You know, is literally New Scotland as a Canadian province. So it has a lot of Scottish settlers and has a lot of names that are derived from Scottish names. So there was a new Glasgow, which is in Nova Scotia. There's also apparently a new Edinburgh, but I'd never heard of it until I was in Edinburgh. And someone was like, yeah, we have one of those in Canada. It's like, really? Do we? Okay. It's very small, I guess. And so I knew how to pronounce these names already. So when I was in Scotland a couple years ago, and this is, somebody said to me, like, here's a name to really stump you. How would you pronounce this? And so this name is spelled Lougbourough. How would you pronounce that, Claire?
I would pronounce that as Loughborough.
That's also what I said. That is apparently not correct. It is Loughborough.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can see that. Like, cough.
Yeah, like cough or laugh, but Loughborough. And the person was telling me this was American, and she was like, yeah, I saw this on a sign, and I just had no idea how to say this, because O-U-G-H is one of those really weird English spelling sequences that could do anything. That's not technically in Scotland. It's in Leicester, which is another word that's really reduced.
Yeah. I mean, if you said to me, we're going to the town of Loughborough, can you write that down?
Yeah.
I would never have spelled it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And this gets us to something that comes up a lot when you talk about accents coming into contact with each other and dialects coming into contact with each other, which is, when you're talking to somebody who has a different accent than you, how much do you accommodate them? How much do you try to talk like them? And how much do you kind of entrench yourself further in how you talk the way you've been talking before?
Yeah, I mean, I found since I've been here, my Australian accent has definitely softened. And I haven't necessarily picked up a hugely Scottish accent, but my particularly broad Australian moments have toned themselves down excessively because it just reduces that friction of having to explain myself to people all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like accommodation, and this is not a linguistic theory, this is just kind of a personal experience theory. I feel like it happens in kind of like three phases.
Mm.
Like when I first go somewhere, I'm like really excited and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to try out all the vowels and like, let's see how this goes. And I sometimes kind of overindulge in that, but I'm also trying not to seem like I'm parroting anybody, but I'm also, I'm like, ooh, this is exciting. Like I'm kind of whispering it to myself and trying to say things. And then after I've been somewhere for like a week or two, I'm like, okay, you know, like I can chill out, kind of know what's going on here. It's not as novel or exciting. And I can kind of chill out and go back to maybe more of my normal accent. But then the flip side happens, where if you stay somewhere long enough, you end up picking up things you aren't necessarily even completely aware of, or you have certain words you know people misinterpret, so you say them in a particular way, and that kind of creates more durable effects on your accent and how you talk at a normal level. And then you talk to your friends and family back home, and they're like, oh, you sound so whatever.
Yeah.
And that's where that kind of sneaks in.
Definitely. I get a lot of comments on like the lexical changes I've made to accommodate kind of living here, and that's something that is picked up on more by friends and family at home, but they do occasionally comment on my accent and they think it's changed, though I think that's wishful thinking on their behalf. But I get comments on my accent a lot at work when I'm interacting with non-Scottish people, because they're always like, oh, I can understand you. Where are you from?
Like, you're not Scottish.
Yeah, basically, because, you know, like a really strong Scottish accent isn't just about the accent. It's also often comes along with people using Scots English, which is kind of a halfway point between English and Gaelic, and so it has a lot of words that are quite unfamiliar. And so you're kind of navigating a difference in accent and in like extreme, almost slang, I guess. And I don't use any of that.
Well, yeah. So Scots is considered a different Germanic language that has its own history. But then there is also Scottish English, which is
something
that's a variety of English. So like, there's
important distinction to make. But yeah, Scottish English does use a lot of these words, like saying tay instead of to and nay instead of no, things like that, which when you're already kind of confused by the accent is made even harder. And so people get really excited when they're interacting with me and they're like, oh, but I can understand you. You're speaking really clearly. I'm like, yes, I'm speaking my very, very softened down, very neutral Australian accent for you, so that you can understand me.
You're trying to speak like kind of like a like semi-internationalized version of Australia.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to speak my most well-enunciated, slang-free version of English.
Which is not necessarily how you talk to your friends and family back in Australia either.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I'm certainly not swearing as much as I would to my friends and family back in Australia. Or
anywhere. I mean, maybe not at work.
Yeah. But yeah, so people often comment on my accent and yeah, they just get really excited that they're not having to work as hard to think about what people are saying to them. And I do understand, because when I first moved here, when I did interact with people with strong Scottish accents, you just kind of get this fear and this moment of, oh no, what if I misunderstand you? What if I have to keep asking you to repeat what you've said and I've gone past that, you know, socially acceptable limit of three times?
Yeah. And like, it kind of creates that friction. Yeah. It was interesting for me, like being in Australia for like 6 weeks, which was long enough for the Australian accent kind of passed from like, ooh, this is really exciting, I'm hearing this all the time, to like, yep, this is just normal. Like, this is what happened. And then before I was there, I couldn't really distinguish between the Australian and New Zealand accents.
Yeah.
Like, I knew that they were different, and I knew, like, linguistically, here's a list of some things, but it wasn't necessarily obvious to me. And then about 5 weeks into being in Australia, I was at a conference with several New Zealanders, and I was like, whoa, this is completely different. I don't know how I ever thought these were the same. There's so much going on. Because I had this, like, Australian baseline that had kind of built itself as I was doing this. But at the same time, I was also very aware that I was talking in a very internationalized version of my accent, which is, you know, I know that there are certain things that are Canadianized expressions, or I know that there are certain things that are less understandable. And like, I'm not doing something like, you know, so like Canadian English, you know, pronounces the R after its vowels, like car park. So it's not like I'm not going to say that because people can understand R's. But I'm very aware that there are certain things that I'm not going to do, or that I'm going to try to like accommodate people on and like produce this internationalized version of what I'm saying. So one fun one that happened to me is I was on a plane. I think this was the Sydney to Melbourne flight, and they were coming around and offering us drinks. And I was like, okay, I want to just sound unremarkable. And I know that accents of English, dialects of English have like tomato and tomato are both options here. And I'm probably a bit more on the tomato side, but like, I have family members who say tomato, like I'm aware that it's an option. I've said it before. I'm not strongly committed to one or the other of these.
Interesting.
So I just want to say in this context, whichever one is going to seem most unremarkable to the person offering me the drink. And yet I couldn't remember which one it was. And I didn't want to be like to the flight attendant, like, hi, are we in a tomato region or a tomato region? It's like, you know, this person's just trying to do their job.
They're not here to teach you pronunciation.
So instead I was like, what kinds of juices do you have?
Sneaky, sneaky, I like.
And they're like, apple juice, orange juice, tomato juice. And I was like, aha. It's like, thank you, I'll have the tomato. But what's interesting that I forgot about is tomato is really interesting for Australian English because it has the different vowel, toma versus tome, but it also has a different thing going on with the T. So Australian English, like Canadian English and like American English, but not like most varieties of British English, pronounces this T between vowels kind of like a very fast D, which is called tapping or flapping if you want to get technical about it. And so you have tomato. Whereas if I was going to say this in a, you know, my fake, my like accommodating towards a UK accent, I'd probably say tomato.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I got the vowel thing from it. Then I was like, oh, I forgot about this TD thing. Now I can also do this other one.
That's one that I was actually very aware of because here in Scotland, they do not do this tapping. And people do always look at me with great amusement when I ask for my water bottle. Because they would say water bottle, which to me feels so forced and is one that I haven't really managed to embrace or accommodate at all. I still completely keep doing that at all times.
I noticed like, because sometimes with certain accents, you get like a keyword or two that can kind of like send you into an accent. And for me, the Australian one was water. Yeah. And I was like, because it's got some, it's got the vowel thing going on with the O, which is more rounded than I would say it. It's got the TD thing going on, and it's got the lack of R. It's just got like so much going on in that one word. And like, as soon as you're like, ah, nah, yeah, I'd like some water. I'm like, yeah, this is the best Australian accent I can do.
It definitely kind of embraces all those elements of the fast-spoken, lazy Australian accent that kind of a lot of the myths about it come from.
Yeah, like there's a lot of vowel reduction and vowel shift in the Australian accent, but I have this TD thing. And a lot of varieties of British English, instead of taking a T to like this very fast D sound, they instead take it to a glottal stop. So you have like wa. Or bottle.
Yes, yeah.
And so that's just a different way of dealing with that same sound. But yeah, you'd have to say like water.
That's what I encounter here is water, pronounced so beautifully, just enunciated perfectly. And I just, it still feels like...
It just feels too fancy for you.
Excessive pronunciation.
Water bottle.
All these letters.
Yeah, you can't do it.
Yes. But I find if my life does go smoother if I just say, can I please have that water bottle?
Yeah.
Instead of water bottle, which I like to blur into one word as fast as I can.
Me too. Water bottle.
Yeah, water bottle. Why pronounce all the letters when you could just not?
But the other one that I had in my Australian keyword is this oh yeah, yeah, nah, nah, yeah thing, which I love.
Yeah, nah. We're pretty good at that.
And I don't know why... Because I have, like, yeah, no, no, yeah. Like, I have a version of that. The vowels aren't quite as reduced, but I know what they both mean. Like, I know what this difference is between yeah, nah, and nah, yeah. And I don't know if this is something that English speakers in general do know what these combinations mean, or if this is, yeah, like, I don't know what exactly the bit is about it that makes it more Australian.
I couldn't tell you either. I'm a bit too close to that one in a way. I know that my brother does yena a lot as almost one word, and more so than na, but over here, you almost never hear na.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's always nay.
Oh, of course.
So I don't ever hear yena in Scotland.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm probably more likely to say, like, yano or yana, but, like, not quite as... I think that might be slightly different. This was something, so I noticed when I was in Scotland a couple of years ago, and I was kind of gradually accommodating people, and especially because I was the only Canadian in the groups that I was hanging out with, you know, other linguists at the University of Glasgow and the University of Edinburgh, and I was the only Canadian, and there were very few Americans around either, and I was really kind of shamelessly taking advantage of the fact that no one had very strong ideas of what a Canadian accent was supposed to sound like.
Were you lying to them, Gretchen?
No, I was not lying to them. I do not... I don't think it's lying to say different vowels. But, you know, if they'd had a strong expectation of how I'd been supposed to talk, or if there'd been, like, several Canadians there, then I think I would have been more reluctant to try to accommodate people quite as closely, because I've been like, well, someone's going to notice.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, Canada, I was able to trade on kind of the stereotypes of, well, you know, Canada's kind of more like us. Like, of course she doesn't sound American. No. so I was looking back at some of my tweets from when I was there, because I did a Twitter thread about being a Canadian in Australia and thinking some of my reflections on that. And then I did some various tweets about being a Canadian in Scotland and, like, what was happening to my accent and which things were conscious and which things weren't. Here's an example for you. You know that bunch of stones all stacked up on top of each other between Scotland and England, historically, that was built by the Romans? Hadrian's
Wall.
Okay. So I would normally, most of the time, say Hadrian's Wall.
Yeah.
But after I'd been in the UK for a while, I started saying Hadrian's Wall.
It's so funny hearing you say them together.
And also words like dance, which I would normally say dance, I started saying things like dance a little bit more. And not completely consistently, but, like, enough that I knew that that was kind of going in that direction. And it was interesting being in Australia a couple of years later, because I think my brain was like, ooh, we're in, like, other version of English time. And I started saying dance there, even though about half of the Australian dialects have dance in the first place.
Yeah, I say dance.
My brain was like, oh, you know you're in other accent territory. Here's the time to do it.
It's like, your one opportunity to shine.
Like, this is fake. What are you doing here? This isn't even particularly Australian. But yeah, things like wall, which is not really a vowel that I have at all anywhere in my native dialects, but was something that I picked up. But wall was one that I remembered. And I completely forgotten about this until I saw myself having said it on Twitter a couple years ago. Apparently, for about 12 hours after leaving Scotland, I was still saying the pronoun I, as in me, as ah. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And if we just, even while talking to English people, because I went from, you know, Edinburgh to London, and then I was still saying ah. And then I, you know, stopped about 12 hours later when I was like, wait, what am I doing? This is not...
No one needs this anymore. No.
Like, this is... I don't normally talk like this. But I wasn't doing any of the kind of stereotyped Scottish features like tay and day and I and this kind of stuff. Because I was like, I don't want to seem like I'm parodying somebody or like I'm actually speaking this. I just... The subtle ones that people aren't as aware of are just kind of going to get a little
That's
bit
closer. That's what you've fallen
into. Yeah.
I spent a lot of time being very mean and parodying my friend's northern English accent, and then found myself naturally slipping into saying no in a mock northern English accent. The rest of it was always very forced, but that no felt really natural to me. And I had to consciously stop myself saying it.
I think different people have different levels of accommodation, different tendencies towards accommodation, because you talk to especially people who are linguists or have kind of an interest in language.
Mm.
Because you have this interest in language, I feel like you're more likely to try to kind of glom on to other accents or kind of end up shifting towards those. And there's this worry that, oh no, people are going to think that I'm parodying them.
Yeah.
And I definitely don't try to do anything that comes to the realm of parody because I don't want to be making fun of someone.
Yeah.
But I also think of it as, like, everyone has an accent. There's no non-accented version, right?
Yeah.
And when I'm talking to someone and they make their speech a bit more like mine in a subtle sort of way, I don't think of them as putting on an accent. I just think of them as having less of an accent.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's like if you're, while you're talking to me, making your speech sound more Canadian, unless you're doing it in a parodying sort of... you know, exaggerated, forced sort of way. But if you're just doing it very subtly, I'm not thinking, oh, this person is putting on a Canadian accent. I'm thinking of this person is having less of this accent that I don't have, right?
Yeah.
And so that made me feel better about the fact that I also, you know, edge towards other people's accents, thinking, okay, well, they're not going to be thinking of me as putting on a British accent or putting on an Australian accent or putting on a Scottish accent. They're going to think of me as, like, having less of a Canadian accent.
Yes.
Even though, of course, I perceive my own speech as unaccented.
Yeah. Everyone sees their own accent as being neutral. And so if you're speaking more like them, they're just going to feel like you're becoming more quote-unquote neutral.
Yeah, which is kind of relaxed me a lot to think about it this way.
That's good.
And I think the way to make it seem less forced, because I don't particularly enjoy people who are like, oh, let me say some Canadian words like a boot. And I'm like, that's not how you say it. and that can get into parody a lot. But if someone's just talking casually and not calling attention to themselves.
Yeah.
And approximating my vowels a bit more closely, I'm not necessarily going to notice. I'm just going to feel like we have a rapport. So if my accent's accommodating someone else's, I try to just not make a very big deal about it in either direction, because I think the ones you make a big deal about turn more into parody.
Yeah, definitely. Do you find that you have a similar experience with accents and French as a non-native French speaker?
So this is really interesting for me, because the French that I learned growing up in school was European French. Which is kind of ridiculous, because the whole reason I was learning French in school was because of Quebec.
Yeah.
And yet they didn't actually teach us Quebec French, even though the reason we were learning French in school was because of Quebec.
Is that like some kind of elitism thing? Yeah. Or was that just a miscommunication and intent?
No. This is definitely an elitism thing. Like, okay. European French is more prestigious. Like, quote-unquote standard. And English is a bit more pluricentric than French is.
Yeah.
Because in English, at least, we often recognize, like, oh, well, there's American English and there's British English, even though there are lots of people like us that don't fall into that dichotomy very neatly. But at least we kind of recognize that English has some degree of pluricentrism, whereas French really just, like, does not recognize that. Like, French is still unicentric, like, it's Paris or it's nothing.
Yeah.
And so even, like, Quebec kids in schools are sometimes taught European French because it's, like, the better French.
Wow.
Ideologically. Even though, of course, that's not actually how they're speaking to each other. But that's what the textbooks and so on are set up for in many ways.
Yeah.
And so it was very interesting for me because I learned French with a mostly European accent, but I was exposed to, like, some Quebec speakers, and so I kind of had both running along. But I had a European accent in French, even in undergrad, because I went to my undergrad in an English-speaking province, and I, you know, the French department there had some people from Quebec and some people from France, but I still had this France accent. And then I moved to Montreal in 2011. And I was like, okay, A, I want to speak French while I'm here, because it seems silly to move to a city where I do kind of speak the language and not use that as a chance to get better at it.
Yeah.
And B, I am Canadian and there's no reason why my French should have a European accent.
Yeah, totally.
Like, it's not that I'm European and therefore this is where the accent comes from. It's like, no, the accent that I should have based on, like, where I, like, who I actually am, and if, especially if I'm going to start adopting an identity as a Montrealer, the accent that I should have is Montreal.
Yeah.
And so I made a fair bit of conscious effort to try to make my accent more Quebecois.
That's cool.
Partly, I think it was easier for me because it was second language, because I didn't have as strong allegiances to one side or the other.
Yeah.
And some things, like picking up words, so there's the great chocolate croissant debate about French dialects.
Right. I haven't heard of this, but it sounds delicious.
It is delicious. So, you know, you have like a croissant, which they all call a croissant, which in English we also call a croissant. And then you have the one that has the chocolate in it.
Yes.
What would you call that?
Pain au chocolat.
Okay. So this is, this is one of the three, the three options. So pain au chocolat is a France term for this.
Yeah.
And I think you can also say croissant au chocolat in some regions of France, but it's not as very common. But in Quebec, you call it a chocolatine.
Oh, okay. Cute.
Or if you want to say it with a more Quebec accent, you call it a chocolatine. Because Quebec French also has this thing where if you have T or D before the letter I or the letter U, you pronounce them as more like T and Z.
Okay.
So instead of chocolatine, you have chocolatine. Or vendu, you have vendu. Like, that's a pronunciation feature, and then you can kind of see it show up in certain particular words. So I remember when I was first living here and still figuring this out, I was at a bakery or something, and I asked for a pain au chocolat, and the person, like, gave it to me, but she's like, where are you from? And he's like, oh no, I've messed
instantly
up.
Instantly knows. It's like a shibboleth, but for bakeries.
Like a bakery shibboleth. And people sometimes, like, especially the first year that I was here, they would often think I was from, like, some French-speaking European country that was not France.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So they'd be like, are you Belgian? Are you Swiss? Because I think it was like, maybe they could tell that French wasn't necessarily my first language. So, you know, if I was Belgian, like my first language could be Flemish or like Swiss German or something like this. But I'm speaking French. But I'm speaking French with like not quite the accent they're expecting, but like also not quite like a purely Parisian accent, which is the one that they're exposed to a lot from media and stuff. So they know what that one's supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, maybe you're from Belgium.
I mean, it's good that they're aware that there are other French-speaking places.
Yeah. And I was like, this is very interesting. But no. But, I mean, these days I don't get that anymore. That was like the first year or two that I was here. I got that several times.
Yeah.
But I have been kind of like consciously switching myself over to certain things. But again, there's also stuff that I hear people do here that I just don't do because it's not quite where I am. And it feels like, it still feels like to do it would be parody. If someone says merci, thank you, what most people learn in, you know, French classes, the response to that is de rien, like it was nothing.
Right.
Which is definitely available here, but it's less common than another one, which is a kind of loan translation from English, which is bienvenue, which literally means welcome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was like, that's weird. That's familiar. Is that not?
No, you say like, bienvenue à Montréal, welcome to Montreal, like that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's not idiomatic in other varieties of French to say bienvenue in response to merci.
Which is kind of funny because when you pointed out in French how it's not quite natural, you realize how it's kind of a weird thing to say in English as well. But yeah.
It's a really weird thing to say. Like, why are we saying this?
Yeah.
I mean, all of these like stock phrases are really weird. Like,
yeah.
what does thank you even mean other than that thing you say when?
Yeah.
What does your welcome even mean other than that thing you say when? And English is undergoing its own shift from you're welcome to things like no worries and no problem.
Oh, I'm a no worries gal for sure.
Yeah, I think that's very Australian. I mean, I say it too, but like people tell me it's Australian.
Yeah, here it's nay bother.
Oh.
Which I've taken to using. I don't know how much the accent has followed through, but as one of the lexical items I've very much adopted.
Because it's just so common.
Yeah, it's so common and it feels comfortable because no worries is quite Australian. So nay bother, again, like doesn't interrupt the flow of conversation as much.
Mm, yeah, that makes sense. I think I probably say no problem most, but I also say no worries or like NP if we're talking internet style. One of the like most popular posts on my blog from many years ago that still keeps coming up in Google is like this difference between you're welcome and no problem.
Oh, yeah.
And there's this like older generations getting annoyed. Like, why do people say no problem? Like, you should be saying you're welcome.
It's not proper.
It's not as proper. And then the flip side, younger people saying, well, I actually interpret you're welcome as kind of sarcastic or a little bit snarky. Like, you're welcome.
Yeah.
As this kind of like reminder to say that. And so you see themselves as being more sincere by using a newer expression because it's become a little bit less fossilized.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
I would say I think of no problem or no worries as more sincere than you're welcome. I'm definitely on that side of that.
Definitely.
But it's interesting that the flip side of this is happening in French, where Quebec French has picked up bienvenue as like the new way to say you're welcome, even as your welcome is fading in English. Like, these are all kind of arbitrary stock phrases, but the arbitrary stock phrases has shifted. And, like, I don't know, maybe after another, like, what, 8 years here, I'll pick up bienvenue, but I don't think I've ever said it in this context. I hear people say it all the time, and I'm like, I know what you mean. I just
I feel you, but I can't say it.
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. So I think this is one of those topics that is very deeply personal to people. A lot of what we choose to say is based on specific interactions. We remember somebody making fun of a particular phrase or remember someone saying it and liking it or trying to make yourself get along better or occasion less questions. And
yes,
it's one of those topics that like people have so many interesting stories about. So this is one of the ones that I want to say, like tell us your stories about this.
Yeah, it would be great to hear about other people and their experiences of mixing accents and how they accommodated or didn't accommodate new accents that they encountered.
Yeah, absolutely. So floor's open. Tell us your stories about accent accommodation.
For
For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I can be found as @GretchenAMXC on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com.
Lauren tweets and blogs as Superlingo, and I can be found at ClaireGorn.com. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gorn. Our audio producer is Claire Gorn, our managing editor is Emily Greff, and our production editors are A.E. Prevost and Sarah Doppiarella. Our music is by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!